Hello, and welcome to Baltic Ways, a podcast bringing you interviews and insights from the world of Baltic studies. I'm your host, Dr. Indre Ekmanis, and today we'll listen to a discussion with Dr. Saulius Sužiedėlis, Professor Emeritus of History at Millersville University of Pennsylvania, and the leading expert on the history of World War II and the Holocaust in Lithuania. Dr. Sužiedėlis speaks about his decades studying a complex, traumatic period, the dynamic nature of history, and the future of Baltic studies. Stay tuned. Dr. Sužiedėlis, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Perhaps we can start by you telling us a little bit about your background as a historian and how you came to be involved in Baltic studies.
Yes, I got my doctorate at the University of Kansas back in 1977, which was, of course, a different world back then. And a typical member of my age of the diaspora, I came to America as a child and participated in all the ethnic organizations and all that. My academic training was in European history, and then at Kansas with Russian East European history with a concentration on Poland and the Baltic states. I did part of my dissertation research at the University of Warsaw in the mid-1970s, and then taught at a community college, and later here at Millersville University. I worked with the Voice of America for about a year and a half, doing sort of opinion pieces, and as a radio journalist, I did a lot of history broadcasts aimed at the community in the late 1980s, 89, 90 in particular, which, as you know, is a period of considerable turmoil and even revolution. So that's the background I come from. My focus in research, I did work for 5 years approximately for the Department of Justice in what's popularly known as the Nazi hunting outfit, but I will call it the Office of Special Investigations, as a research historian. And I left that office in 1987. And since then, I've done a considerable amount of research on the Holocaust, World War II issues. Those are, as you probably know, issues which evoke often a visceral response among many people, particularly in the Baltic countries and even Eastern Europe generally, in a way that is different from the reaction to World War II issues than it is in the United States. So I was fortunate to live in this bipolar, some would say bicultural world, in which I can integrate in my personality the Western view of the war, but also understand the attitudes of people who had a completely different experience. In the past few years, for about a decade, I was also a co-director and director at Millersville University of the Conference on Genocide and Holocaust. And I was the president of the Baltic Studies Association for 2 years, and I edited the journal for about 5 or 6 years. So I've been a member of the Journal of Baltic Studies and the association, AABS community, and have never missed a conference, as far as I can tell, in the past 2 decades.
Thank you for sharing that background. This positionality that you point to as being both part of the immigré communities and also studying this history of World War II that evokes visceral reactions is quite compelling. And for context for our listeners, you've also noted that most of the narratives of the Second World War that resonate with Americans are centered on events like the tragedy of Pearl Harbor or the heroic saga of D-Day. But it's not always part of the collective American memory that the vast majority of victims who died between the early 1930s and VJ Day in August of 1945 were civilians in China and Eastern Europe. Noted historian Timothy Snyder has described Eastern Europe as the bloodlands in his massive study of the crimes of Hitler and Stalin and their totalitarian regimes. Of course, the Holocaust stands out as an unparalleled horror. In Lithuania, historians estimate that nearly 200,000 Lithuanian Jews, or more than 90% of the pre-war community, perished at the hands of the Nazis and their accomplices between 1941 and 1944. I wonder if you can speak about the work of historians then in the study of this devastating period, and in history and how it has progressed over the years?
Yeah, well, I think the big change that has occurred in the field since about 1990, obviously, is the opening of the archives in Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and I know the situation in Lithuania, of course, best of all. Almost all studies about the Holocaust, particularly as relating to, and even, well, not only the Holocaust, but Soviet crimes against humanity of the period, relating to that region, did not have access to these, I would say, at least tens of thousands of extremely valuable pages of archival materials that were restricted under Soviet rule. And on the other hand, were not available to the diaspora scholars or the diaspora activists as they sought to wrap their minds around the subject. This is the big change. And so what has happened, and I've been a participant in that process, a generation of historians has come out of the late 80s, early 90s, post-Soviet generation, which has had access to these materials and has studied in the West and is familiar with the Western narrative. And that has changed the thing. Unfortunately, the problem has been that most scholars who have dealt with the Holocaust, particularly from Germany and Western countries, even Israel, first of all, do not know the Baltic languages. And the majority of this material that we have for a local administration in the German occupation, to take an example, is in these languages, alongside German and Russian and so on, of course. And that really takes them out of the game in a way. And so what we have, when you read a history of the Holocaust and you see references to the Baltic states, any scholar who works in Lithuania or has knowledge of the archival material will notice mistakes right away. Some of these are simply results of the fact that they not only do not have access to the archival material as a whole, with some exceptions, but they cannot read the vast amount of historiographic literature that has been published, say in Lithuania, about the Holocaust in particular, in the last, I would say, 20 years. Now, this has been a process of three decades now from 1990. And I would say that currently the most extensive research on the Holocaust in Lithuania is done by ethnic Lithuanian historians under the age of 50 or 45, some of whom learned Hebrew and Yiddish and can use those materials as well. But much of that material is not yet available to Western scholars who might want to read about it. And so some of the stereotypes and misunderstandings of the history come from this dynamic, evolving situation. I would say that Peter Hayes, a historian who's written a book called Why the Holocaust, published a few years ago, made a very interesting point in his work. He said, and I can read the statement, I think, which is worth sort of pondering in this situation. And he writes that the pace of specialist research in the Holocaust, and this really goes quite well with what's happening in the Baltic states, the pace of specialist research has outrun most people's ability to keep up and integrate these new findings into a kind of a general interpretive picture, so that the gap has grown between what people think they know about the Holocaust and specialist knowledge. And Paul Levine, who is one of the top researchers of the Holocaust in the region, says that what's happened is a growing gap between scholarship and public memory, a sort of a town and gown problem, as he put it. And this problem, of course, is in a way political, if we understand the word politics in its broadest sense. That is, it comes into the public forum as a matter of discussion. And here the gap becomes quite evident, not only between Western scholars and their limited view of the historiography of what is happening in the Baltic states, but even of the Baltic citizens who have not yet assimilated much of this new specialist knowledge and continue to work on the basis of some stereotypes that are, I think, at best misleading. And so this is the area I find myself in terms of doing scholarly work. And with the attempt always to keep the scholarship itself separate from political considerations, with the understanding, however, that this isn't really, in real life, is not always possible.
You bring up this interesting perspective here and also in your recent article in the Journal of Baltic Studies about the idea of divided memories and divided experiences. Can you perhaps speak a little bit about that, as well as how that factors into the trajectory for the Baltics, especially as we are dealing with these kinds of divided memories today?
Right. I think I said in that article about the historical commissions, of which I'm a part and have worked with it for many years, There is one basic and fundamental fact, and that is that we all know the memories of Jewish survivors about the Holocaust, and their time frame is pretty clear, 1941 to 1944, roughly, with some time before and after. And that experience is ingrained in the public memory of Jews, survivors, as well as the diaspora in general. However, the experience of the war is utterly different for ethnic Lithuanians, to take an example. Of the ethnic Lithuanians who suffered violence during the 20th century, it is my estimate that over 90% were killed after the war, after World War II had technically ended, late 1944 to 40, after the second Soviet occupation of 44, then after 45, the guerrilla war, and so on. And the number of victims in that case was close to about 250,000 people, not all of them killed. But if you take the 40 to 50,000 who were killed during that period, the 150,000 who were deported roughly, the arrests and other repressions, it's a huge number. So the Lithuanian memory is one of after the war as their greatest and painful past memory. And it's very hard to get past this chronological divide. That is, there are two utterly different experiences of what the war meant to ethnic Lithuanians and to Jews. And I, to put it even more bluntly, speaking, let's say, of the parents of my generation who lived through the war, and I have even older siblings who were already close to teenagehood when they experienced the war, the German occupation was not necessarily the worst experience of their lives. This, of course, sounds bad to a Western ear, but it happens to be, I think, the truth. And furthermore, the divide isn't only between, let's say, Jews and Lithuanians, talking about World War II, but between Lithuanians and the experience of the West. When you think about Tom Brokaw's Greatest Generation, that narrative, it's not that it's wrong. It's just irrelevant to the experience of people like my parents, for whom the only anti-fascists they ever knew were Stalinists. And thus that term anti-fascism does not evoke any fuzzy warm feelings necessarily, just from personal experience. And if there's one rule that I've held in terms of talking to people who've experienced the war and being sensitive to their perspective, is that I would never question the person's experience. Of course not. However, if that experience is presented as a memoir, just like any other historical document, then I have to subject it to critical analysis, the same as an archival document. And so that creates a lot of emotional difficulty in dealing with people's memories. I'll give only two examples that are very specific so it could put it into the ground level. There is a mythology among Lithuanians, and not only Lithuanians, but Latvians and Estonians as well, that the collaborationist perpetrators of the genocide in 1941, particularly in 41, were the rabble, small amounts of criminalized rabble, and did not represent the population at large. The truth is, of course, that the Germans were able to access certain administrative structures and utilize a lot more people into that operation than we would like to admit as Baltic citizens. That's one problem. The other issue from the other side of the coin is that many Jews, when you talk to them in the Baltics, in Lithuania in particular, will tell you that thousands of Jews were killed even before the Germans arrived in pogroms. This is a very standard, powerful, and popular narrative, except that it's wrong. And we know from careful research, myself and my colleague Christoph Diekmann, who's worked on this, we don't find that number of people killed before the Germans arrive. And that's just a fact. Now, there were, in the event this huge, the invasion, the Holocaust, you have exceptions to the rule. And there were killings in which the Germans weren't even present. But it was by no means on the scale and as extensive as is sometimes portrayed in memoirs, memories, and conversations, narratives among people. And so then the question becomes, how does a scholar deal with it, this dilemma? And that, of course, is an issue that everyone must face. I find that younger scholars of the generation now who are in their late 30s, post-Soviet people, and not only physically but emotionally, and who have, let's say, spent a year in Yale doing some research or have a fellowship, their attitude, of course, is entirely different. They are not offended by narratives of collaboration as much as older people who really would have some reason to try to doubt the extent of Native collaboration in the Holocaust in 1941 to 44, which was, I want to use the correct adjective here, which was relatively extensive compared to what many people think on the ground today in the Baltic states. So we're not talking about a handful of rabble. We're talking about thousands of people, not by no means the majority. I'm not saying that. And by no means is a collective guilt narrative. But the number of people who participated in atrocities was large, unfortunately. But that's true, obviously, of all of occupied Europe. Western Europe as well. For example, extensive collaboration in the Netherlands by the local police in the deportation of Jews to death camps. And so we have to take this in its proper perspective. That, as you can understand, creates a position where sometimes we come up with so-called irreconcilable differences in memory. And it's very difficult to bridge the gap. It's easier among scholars and specialists who understand the dynamics and are not personally involved in trying to do one narrative or the other. Finally, the point about the difficulty with memories is that certain institutions have constituencies of memory, and that furthers the divide in a way, and I suppose in some sense is inevitable. But I guess all I'm saying in a nutshell is that every scholar who deals with these issues of wartime remembrance and wartime history has to be prepared to really expect a certain amount of blowback, particularly since we're dealing with two occupations, not one. And the temptation is to equate one to the other, or also to sometimes engage in comparisons which are not entirely appropriate. But comparative history is a must, and we must do it in any case.
If we stay at this place where there are these divided memories, these constituencies of memory that perhaps cannot come together, or it's very difficult to close the gap in some of them, what are the next steps, you know, especially in the context of, as you mentioned, this newer generation who is coming up with a little bit more distance from those historical events and perhaps ability to see and to process in a different way than those who feel those memories as their own experiences?
Well, this is an extraordinarily difficult and complex question, because we're dealing with several different levels of knowledge, scholarship, popular narratives, governmental attitudes, and also official policy towards memory. I think that at the current situation is not so terrible, actually. I think in academia, let's take Lithuania, for example. There are at least 40 to 50 scholars who are specialists in either Jewish history, Holocaust, or both. For a small country of about 2.7 million people, that's a lot, actually, if you take a look at the demographics of it. And they've published numerous peer-reviewed studies. In that sense, the situation is, I think, favorable for continuation of more and more knowledge and more sophisticated understanding of these extremely painful issues. The second level is popular narratives, and here we have a different problem. And that is it possible to marginalize those narratives which are clearly antithetical to just plain old morality? You know, let's say the skinhead narratives, the I wouldn't say Holocaust denial, which does not exist in the Baltics in the same way as it does in the West. Everyone knows it took place, but they're rather minimizing it more so. How do we do that? Is it possible without violating freedom of speech and democratic norms? What about the emphasis on the Soviet crimes, which is important and has to be done? On that level, we find another problem, because in the West, in part, the West has bought into the great patriotic war narrative of the Soviet Union. They were allies, after all. In Eastern Europe, for very understandable reasons, that's not a narrative that flies at all. We're sort of sitting here in this narrative in which people sometimes are putting up monuments to persons who fought the Soviets, but have a history of participation and persecution, killing of Jews. We have some specific instances of that in Lithuania and probably in Latvia and Estonia as well. And I think that the governmental position should be, and I think is basically, that participation in the resistance against one occupier cannot justify or elevate them to a position of heroism if they, on the other hand, participated in the persecution killing of their own citizens of different ethnicity under the German occupation. So there's this legal moral conundrum that has to be addressed. It's not easy, because the forces which are defensive about this are strong, in the public narrative, in the press. And so the conflict is unavoidable. There is no way to get around it. I think that in time, with goodwill and with the help of scholars and historians, we can come to an understanding of this. So in a sense, the Baltics are, on the one hand, things are improving. On the other hand, it's a bit of a no-win situation because the Western attitude is sometimes suffused with a certain amount of ignorance about the really complex situation these countries found themselves in. And on the other hand, there you have popular narratives which are sometimes questionable. So you're trapped in this thing. I'll give you one very quick example. My own parents and people of that generation, a narrative that Americans would find almost impossible to understand. And when they fled west in 1944, as hundreds of thousands of Balts did, they were viewed with suspicion by people who thought, you know, why are you leaving our allies and fleeing west with the Germans? The attitude of these people was, look, we want World War II to end the way the First World War ended, which was in their living memory. The Germans will defeat the Russians, and then the Allies will defeat the Germans in turn. And only if that situation prevails will the geopolitical strategic situation evolve, which is favorable for the restoration of national independence, which is the goal. It's very hard for a Westerner to assimilate this perspective. It is, of course, the only illusion which made sense for these people. So you have to understand it. And so during the era of glasnost and the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were Western commentators who blamed the Baltic peoples for their drive for independence and did bring up this World War II Nazi narrative. Some of it sometimes offensive and ignorant, by the way, and not all of it well-informed. That situation has, I think, changed for the better in recent years, but it's still a problem out there. Again, to repeat myself, we're dealing with an extraordinarily complex issue which evokes numerous emotions, various emotions, which are hard to reconcile, but I do think it is worth making the effort.
I wonder if you could maybe speak a little about kind of zooming out into a historian's role writ large, beyond the Baltics and beyond the history of the occupations, but more generally thinking about the way that historians have to approach these very different understandings of truth and or different understandings of memory or different understandings of history writ large. And you know, I think a little bit about, for example, Timothy Snyder's, the way that he has, of course, studied Eastern Europe, but also is able to kind of draw some of those perspectives into current debates. And I wonder if you might speak a little bit about that from your own perspective.
Yeah, I think the historian's job, and history is a dynamic and constantly changing narrative. It doesn't stay in one place. To give an example out of a totally different geographic area, let's take a look at the history of the Confederacy as understood by Americans in 1920 and the way it is understood now in 2020. These are two completely different narratives. The Civil War was an invented narrative in the sense that this war between brothers, if you look at monuments of the so-called Civil War, in the 1860s, you'll see that it's referred to as a rebellion, as a sedition, as treason. The term civil war and that thing that came afterwards was much later and done for certain very political reasons, the lost cause narrative. The job of the historian, I think, in this sense, is to look back and say, look, even if there is no such thing as absolute objectivity in any of the sciences, social or physical, the person who writes about it, who perceives it, brings a perspective. That perspective has to be judged on certain merits, under certain rules of evidence. And to tell the society that these are the rules of evidence that we are following, to say that, for example, unfortunately, during period 41 to 44, a significant part of Baltic people collaborated and participated in the Holocaust in different ways. And to point out, what is our judgment for saying this? Do we have the documentary evidence? And to always point that out, that we are not basing this on any negative thing about Baltic people or that they are behaving badly, but simply that the historical record shows a certain development. I know this sounds a little bit airy-fairy in the sense that we're historians would be the do-gooders to teach society something. But it's extremely important because if they look at the example in the United States of the current war about Confederate monuments and so on, this narrative brings to the surface right away racial tensions, as we know now from American experience. And the same thing happens in the Baltic to a certain extent. And the job of the historian is to lean back, try to stay above the fray on a certain level without losing our own sort of duty as citizens and moral people to call out lies when they're lies, for example, but to say, look, let's look at the evidence and take a deep breath and accept our past the way it is and deal with it that way, but always referring to the rules of evidence and explaining to people that expertise does matter and that not everyone can fly a jumbo jet. Not everyone can be a historian. You can write about history. It doesn't make you a historian. That is why some of the popular narratives tend to get lost along the way a little bit. And that, of course, will make historians to a certain degree unpopular to everyone, because when there's a conflict on both sides of this type that is very diametrically opposed, whatever you say is going to be disliked or will be opposed by people even on different sides of the same issue. And I've actually experienced that myself. But I think there is a room for historians to take the longer look, to tell society that we are observing rules of evidence, we're doing the best we can, and acknowledge mistakes when we make them. My own view of the Holocaust Lithuania is not the same today in 2020 as it was in 1990. I have evolved certain of my views. I see it differently now than I did back then, simply because I've spent enough time in the archives looking through many documents, spoke to many people, read some secondary literature. So we have to keep reminding people that this is the process by which historians come to approximate the truth best they can.
Thank you for that. That kind of helps to put all of this into context in and of itself, and the kind of learning curve that society goes through too, right? Even in this example of understanding the difference between a perspective in the 1990s and then the addition of evidence and how that kind of evolves our own thinking. Something that perhaps the United States is going through right now as we uncover more and more truths about our own history. To take maybe even another step back, I wonder if you might reflect a little bit on the state of Baltic studies and the association from your time and participation.
I think the biggest change that has happened, of course, is the opening up to people from the Baltics. And that has been an extremely fruitful endeavor in terms of the younger scholars who now have a perspective not only of particularly young scholars coming from the Baltics who have had time to go to Stanford, to visit American universities, study under Western scholars themselves. And this has really been facilitated very well by Baltic studies. I think our conferences in that case are very, very successful. And I think there's a good future for it. And this is, I think, one of the better things that Baltic studies does. Presents the perspective of Baltic people in a reasonable, rational way to people outside the world of the Baltic states, the Baltic diaspora, that aren't aware of, for example, the Soviet crimes against humanity, which are such a big topic in among Baltic peoples, and that are not aware about the complexities of where many of these attitudes come from that Baltic people have about the war that we've been talking about. So, you know, and I think that has something to do with current events, because Baltic young people are, after all, products of their countries. And they may have a very different attitude towards NATO, for example, than some people on the American left, a far more positive one, for very obvious reasons. And so I think this is a very healthy input, especially when it's done with a scholarly, evidence-based sort of narrative that can be presented to people outside the what we can call the Baltic community.
That's a great way to contextualize the value of Baltic studies beyond the association and the way that it can kind of contribute more broadly to our understandings of these larger multinational institutions. But I really appreciate the ability to speak with you, and thank you for a really fascinating discussion.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks. And I'm sure we'll run into each other at the next conference, I hope.
Thank you for tuning in to Baltic Ways, a podcast from the Association for the Advancement of Baltic Studies, produced in partnership with the Baltic Initiative at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. A note that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AABS or FPRI. I'm your host, Dr. Indra Ekmanis. Subscribe to our newsletters at aabs-balticstudies.org and fpri.org/Baltic-initiative for more from the world of Baltic studies. Thanks for listening. See you next time.